Aní nindaway maganaduk, ni gagwege tamagas. Bine sikwe de go makwando deam, gababani kagish, kanaganing and lunjabami gwich. Thank you very much for the honor of being here with you today. I've had a really beautiful time in my visit up here to Alaska and just to this community, and for the honor of being here on your land and in your community, and just happy to be here in this time, Omaa King. I'm telling you where I'm from, which is the White Earth Reservation, which in northern Minnesota. Y'all know where Minnesota is, basically? So northwestern Minnesota, kind of between Bemidji and Fargo. That's where I live. I'm going to show a map in a little bit that shows exactly. But I'm Bear Clan, and you know, I was looking at some pictures for these young women. How do you say your community? Chivac from the air, and I live in a place that looked like that. It's like 10,000 lakes where I live, and my reservation has 500 bodies of water and 47 lakes. So you know, remind me of it, how it looks from the air. Happy to be here. My partner Don is in the back. I'm going to give the wave, Don. He's in the, he traveled up here boldly with me. But he liked it. He lived up here for about 6 years, and so he likes it up here quite a bit. So what I wanted to talk about tonight is Onoshishin Ajichgewin, to make it beautiful, making it beautiful. And I'm interested in the idea of, you know, there's a lot of ugly things that go on in the world. And I'm interested in how we make things beautiful and how we reaffirm the beauty, you know, that the Creator gave us, and how, you know, for a lot of our villages, our towns, you know, the question that I ask is really this question of how do you make it beautiful 25 years from now or 50 years from now? What's our villages going to be like? Where's our water going to come from? Where's our food going to come from? Where's our energy going to come from? You know, what's the weather going to look like? How are we going to treat each other? How are we, you know, what are our children going to be thinking? Are we going to be healthy? You know, those are questions about self-determination. Those are questions about what the future looks like. And you know, the questions that I have is like, who's in charge of that? Is that somebody someplace where else, you know? Is that someone in Washington, D.C. or in Anchorage, or, you know, who is in charge? And, you know, as I look around, I come from a community that's a small, you know, tribal community, a reservation community, and the big town is about this size near us. You know, this is about the size town I go into when I go to town. You know, these are questions that are faced by all of us, no matter what color or, you know, wherever we are from, and they're going to be really important questions, and they are. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that story and the story that we have in our own community about that. I'm going to start with this picture. This is a painting. It's a mural. It's on a wall in Duluth. And Duluth is a city where, you know, I know that there's a lot of violence against Alaskan Native women. And in Minnesota, there's also a lot of violence against Native women. It's a lot of missing and murdered Indigenous women. And Duluth is a city where a lot of that has occurred over the years. And in many ways, we're kind of invisible in Duluth. And a couple of years ago, some artists, this artist named Votan and ICO, a community organization in Duluth, an American Indian Community Health Organization, decided to put an Indian woman up in downtown Duluth. So this woman, she's a water protector, and she's about 40 feet by 60 feet. She's on 2nd Street and 2nd Avenue, and so we're very visible in Duluth today. And I think in a lot of ways, I am a water protector also. And this is a little story about us as water protectors as well. I was just going to say one other quick story is a week ago Monday, I flew to Washington, D.C. to do something I never thought I would do in my whole life, which is that I introduced a new ice cream flavor. And so Ben and Jerry's is a very good ice cream company. You know, I laugh because I'm pretty lactose intolerant, so I'm not pasteurizing. But I understand Alaska eats more ice cream than any other state, which I had no idea, and that's I'm not sure why that is, but I'm glad that you do. But this ice cream, the proceeds of this ice cream, it's a limited edition ice cream, but there's four organizations that receive the proceeds from this limited edition. And you know, people working to protect people's rights at the border, women's rights, and address, you know, Color Lines, which is addresses a lot of the issues of just racism in America. And then our organization, Honor the Earth, I direct this organization, which is an Native environmental organization. And so I was really proud of that, and I just want to share that with you. And so I don't know if there's any ice cream up here in your town, but you know, if you want to check her out, this is an opportunity. So I want to talk a little bit about this, where I live. Gawawiye Gamag, that's my language. I'm Anishinaabe Moana, we're Algonquin speakers. I don't think there's Algonquin speakers up here in Alaska, but this month in our language is called Gashkanogizis, which means when it freezes over, freezing over moon. And then we have a Manitou Gizisuns, which is a little spirit moon. Gitche Manitou Gizis, a great spirit moon. Then we have a moon that is called Nemeibin Gizis, which is when the suckers move under the ice. Do you have suckerfish here? No. Then Onalbana Gizis, which is a hard-crusted snow moon. That's about March, when the snow starts to freeze and thaw and freeze again. Also known as the moon you don't want to do a faceplant in the snow. Is Kigami Zigigizis, which is a syruping moon. Then our moon is Wabagana Gizis, flower moon. Mean Gizis, the blueberry moon. Odeimitagizis, strawberry moon. And then Manomitake Gizis, our wild rice making moon. And so I thought you might want to hear a little bit about the moons in my territory. I don't know. I know your berries probably come in during the summer, same time, right? Different kind. But that's my language. And you know, a couple things you probably know about that, which is probably similar to the languages here, which is that first, that's our calendar is really based on our world that we live in. And did you also notice that none of those moons was named after a Roman emperor? Did y'all get that? So I want to just point out that it's possible to have an entire worldview that has nothing to do with the empire. And it's okay. It's all good. Let it go. This is some art from our area. I don't know that your art looks like this, but this is Anishinaabe art. And it's characterized by being able to look inside the beings. And it's also, you know, a lot of times there's lines that relate the beings to each other to show in Dinaway Mugginatook that we are all related. And the reason I'm showing you this art is that, as you gathered from my resume, which sounds really long when you're listening to it and you're mean, that, you know, I spent a lot of time in school. And, you know, when I was in college, when I was at Harvard, if you wanted to study the art from Europe, you went to the fine arts department. But if you wanted to study indigenous art, you went to anthropology. And so I want to point out that is that's a valuation of some people's knowledge over others. And that it's really important to me to recognize, you know, among many things, that we're not second class, you know, in who we are, in our intellectual traditions and in our artistic traditions. And then I also want to say, actually, that at this moment in time, it's really important that we bring in all kinds of knowledge, because we face a lot of challenges. And those challenges are going to take all of us, and all of our knowledge, and all of our beauty, and all of our gifts together to make a difference. And, you know, so I think of that, and I also think of that it's important to consider that perhaps the solution to the problems we are facing today will not be found in the paradigm which created those problems. It is possible that if you made the problem, you don't know how to fix it. So that is just a little bit about this art. And this piece of art is called We Are All in the Same Boat, which is, I think, pretty much true. You know, we all face very similar challenges, no matter where we come from. So I want to talk about making America great again, okay? And I want to say that because this is my idea of when America was great. It's when there are 8,000 varieties of corn. And those corn, you know, just to point this out, corn doesn't exist in nature. Corn is teosinte. In nature, that's the form of it, which looks kind of like a wheat. And it was adapted from that by humans. You know, we are the ones who worked with it, figured out, you know, how to make 8,000 varieties So I say that because, you know, there's a lot of misinformation about what indigenous people were doing over here before we were all discovered. You know, and I want to point out that we're busy. we're making corn varieties, you know, 8,000 varieties of them. And that work was not done by Monsanto and Syngenta corporations. That was done by indigenous women because women are often the best at seed selection because we often garden. And we also often cook with the food. And so you know which squash is good and which one is not. You also know which keeps best, right? You know which seeds might be best of them. And so this is, you know, that is why women are very good at seed selection. But I grow corn, I'll talk about it later, but I remember one time I was growing pink corn and someone said, why do you grow pink corn? And I said, because I like pink. And then they said, you should grow blue corn. And I said, no, you should grow blue corn. There are 8,000 varieties. There's a color for everybody. That's when America was great, tremendous agrobiodiversity. America was great when there were 50 million buffalo. And those buffalo grazed on grasses, 250 different species of grasses, and tremendous biodiversity. That same area of land today, there are about 28 million cattle that require a massive amount of fossil fuels infrastructure to support them. 50 million buffalo, same territory. America was great when there was wild rice everywhere. These are our beings, Nana Buju and his grandmother, Nokomis. They are out harvesting wild rice in our territory. America was great when the skies were blackened as the birds would fly overhead, when there were fish in every river and lake, and when you could drink the water in all of those lakes. That's when America was great. And so I want to say that because I didn't, you know, there's this term which is historical amnesia. We forget what happened, and I don't have that. And I think it's important that we don't have that. And I also don't want us to have ecological amnesia, which is that you forget that something was there once. Because all of those beings were there, and all of those beings are part of this world that we know that the Creator gave us. And so I say that because I've traveled a lot, and sometimes you go someplace and they say, I think there used to be something there, right? Michigan, I think there used to be wild rice there. And then you look in an old map and they say, yeah, it was. So we want to be the people that try to keep things there or bring things back. Right? So this is a little the problem. Conflict between worldviews. This would be Custer and Sitting Bull. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the difference between those worldviews and you know, say that in our prophecies as Anishinaabe people, it's said that in our prophecies we are told that a time would come, it's called the time of the seventh fire. And in that time, it said that we as Anishinaabeg people would have a choice between two paths, two mikana. And one path, they said, would be well-worn, but it would be scorched. And the other path, they said, would not be well-worn, and it would be green. And it would be our choice upon which path to embark. And our prophets told us that a really long time ago, that that time would come. And they say that that is the time that we are in now, that we must make a choice upon which path to walk. And what I'm pretty sure about is that that is not just an Anishinaabe reality. That is the reality that we are facing in this world. As indigenous people, as Alaskans, as Americans, as people who live in this world, what are we going to do for our future? So let me talk a little bit about the scorched path. No, I'm not going to talk for a great time about this. But we have entered a time when there are catastrophes of biblical proportions. There are catastrophes of biblical proportions. Hurricane Michael that set down in Florida about a month and a half ago, third worst storm recorded in history of the United States, 12th large storm of this year. To the far south, there are certainly many many hurricanes and storms. To the west, you have the entire West Coast that was on fire this year, from California to British Columbia. Catastrophes of biblical proportions. To the north, from what I can see, you have islands and villages falling into the ocean. It is occurring throughout Alaska, and Pacific islands everywhere are falling into the ocean because of climate change and the melting of the glaciers and the massive storm fronts that now move into our territories. And to the east, with all due respect, you have a man with orange hair who is screaming, burning down the house. It's a Talking Head song. This is the price of climate change related disasters as it increases. Now, Munich Re, which is the world's largest reinsurance company, Munich Re predicted that by 2020 we would be spending 20% of world GDP on climate change related disasters. I have no idea if that is true. I know that 2020 is only a couple of years away, but I know that the costs have been increasing exponentially for climate change related disasters in many parts of the world and certainly in the United States. You know, for those of us who are homeowners, I often look and wonder how it is that we're supposed to insure these homes on the beach in South Carolina or homes in the middle of California wildfire territory. Increasingly expensive. And then the question becomes, who's going to pay for that? How does all that get paid for? And I don't actually know the figures that are coming out of the villages in northern Alaska and the coastal villages that are to be removed and relocated, but I know that it is very expensive. And I know that there's actually not a final tally, nor do I have any idea about the costs for this year because a lot of them are not added up. You know, but what I know is that I'm an economist by training. Risk aversion is a good idea. Risk aversion is a good idea. You should try to figure out how to have some control over your economy. And we are in a very precarious situation due to a lot of decisions that have been made that put us in a state where we don't know how we're paying for anything or what the costs of things are or exactly what is going to happen at any point in the future. Not that we knew before, but there was a little bit more that we understood as far as when the salmon would move, as far as when the ice would come. So this is my little story. There's my reservation White Earth in the middle of this map. Obviously, I should have blown this up a little. I have to take PowerPoint 101 again. This is Minnesota. And that green is our treaty territory as Anishinaabe people. We are people who live a somewhat similar subsistence life to many of you. We do not have caribou or moose. We had moose, climate change, hunting. They are not with us now. But we eat a lot of deer, fish, wild rice, very strong harvesting season, maple sugar, trapping, muskrats, a lot of fish with all those lakes. So not that different in many ways than you. And then we also garden. We don't have any oil. We don't have any oil. So what happened is that in the 1960s, a set of oil pipelines were put across our territory. That's this northern here. Those were put across in the 1960s by the Enbridge Company to get tar sands oil to Superior, the furthest inland port, right? Nobody really knew about it. It was before the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, any environmental law, so they just pretty much laid pipe. I think that story can be repeated in a lot of places. They laid it across Fond du Lac, where these ladies are from. And nobody was really paying attention to it because it was just pipes, right? And some of those pipes got kind of old, and so some of them are leaking. And that's where we got the Kalamazoo spill, out of those pipes. And America has an entire infrastructure problem with these pipes because as a country, a first world country, we actually have a D in infrastructure. And our energy infrastructure is crumbling because it was built in the 1960s. And a lot of it was built with, you know, materials, and they're collapsing. So what happened to us is that we're up there minding our own business, eating a lot of wild rice and maple sugar, fish, doing cool things. And one day they announced a new pipeline. And what they want to do is put a new pipe on the southern route. The first pipe they want to put up is called the Sandpiper, which is a fracked oil pipe out of North Dakota. And we didn't really know much about it because we hadn't paid attention to the last round of pipes. But all of a sudden they want to throw a new pipe up and they want to go a new route because the Indian people of this reservation in the middle called Leech Lake said they couldn't go through there. And so they want to bust a new route. And so I went out and, you know, we had to get educated about this. So I had to go read up a lot about pipeline safety and maintenance, corporations, barrels per day. These are things that you know, being in Alaska. Pressure per square inch, PSIs. I didn't know any of that stuff. And then we had to figure out what they're trying to do. So we felt that the risk was pretty high, and we also didn't really want a pipeline to go across our wild rice territory, best of our territory. So we launched an opposition battle. I just say that. Went out and informed a lot of people, said that's, you know, and we're pretty multiracial in our area. Talked to our native people, you know, said people didn't like that idea at all. Already had a big spill. And then talked to a lot of non-Indian people. My theory was is that if you got the Norwegians mad, that'd be a good thing. And yeah, they're totally plucky bunch. Every single hearing. Right, see, you guys, half of you are Norwegians, Fry, right? Look at those sweaters. I see the Nordic skiing sweaters. I got you. You're my people. Anyway, so we start going to these hearings, and everybody's turning out for these hearings, you know, on this proposed pipeline. Everybody's saying, well, we don't, you know, we get all the risk. You're passing through our territory. This is not right, you know. So we had a lot of prayers, a lot of ceremonies. We went to all the hearing processes, and one group called the Friends of the Headwaters, which is a non-native group of lakeshore owners, because we have a lot of lakeshore owners, they filed a lawsuit. And they said that they should do an environmental impact statement on that proposed pipeline. And the state of Minnesota didn't want to do an environmental impact statement on that proposed pipeline, and so they appealed that decision, and the Minnesota Appeals Court ordered the state of Minnesota to do an environmental impact statement on that pipeline. Now, I want to point this out to you because I'd really like the system to work. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I feel the state of Minnesota should just do the pipeline EIS to start with instead of us having to sue them to do it, right? I just want the system to work, and you know, it's supposed to. But when they were sued and they started that EIS process, the corporation that was proposing this is called the Enbridge Corporation. That's a very large Canadian corporation that wants to get that oil to market. And so Enbridge got very upset that someone was asking for an EIS, and Enbridge actually canceled the pipeline. And so they did not build the Sandpiper, the 640,000 barrel per day pipeline. And so I want to say that that happened on August 2nd, 2016, that Enbridge announced it would not build that pipeline. So it is possible to stop a big oil pipeline. What I want to say, though, is that another pipeline was going into the west of us. And that they were in a different situation. And that pipeline was proposed by a corporation called Energy Transfer Partners. And that was called the Dakota Access Pipeline. And so the corporation that we have been fighting, Enbridge, went to South Dakota and financed that pipeline so that they could get a pipeline through. And we followed them to North Dakota, to Standing Rock Reservation, because we didn't think it was right for those people either to have this pipeline, because they didn't want the pipeline run right by their water. And you know, their situation there is not unlike the situation of a lot of Alaska Native villages. I mean, first of all, they didn't want the pipeline just north of the city of Bismarck, almost all white. They wanted it to run it just north of the reservation that already had inadequate infrastructure, which is the story of almost every Alaska Native village from what I could figure out. Inadequate infrastructure. So we follow them. This is what we look like. This is the Minnesota resistance to oil pipelines. These are water protectors. These are my sisters. But we went to Standing Rock, and this is what we found. And so these are some pictures of what it is like to be in North Dakota. We refer to North Dakota as the Deep North. there's an immense amount of hatred, and there's an immense amount of oil. That situation is not unique to North Dakota. But that is the being sprayed, water protectors being sprayed after they started bulldozing over a sacred site. They started attacking our people. And so this, she didn't even know what she got sprayed with. But it was like, all kinds of chemicals spraying on people. These are water protectors. And this is the some equipment that was brought into Standing Rock. $38 million was spent at Standing Rock to repress water protectors who were unarmed. $38 million. This is what $38 million looks like. The piece of equipment on the right, I didn't actually know what that was. I had to ask someone. It's called an MRAP. It's a mine-resistant armored personnel carrier. Mine-resistant armored personnel carrier. You can see on the side it says Stetson County. Now, Stetson County is a county in North Dakota without a lot of people in it. We'll go with 5,000 people. And this piece of equipment is used to drive through a building, like it would drive through this building, right? But there's nothing in Stetson County with 5,000 people that needed a piece of equipment like that. This piece of equipment on the left is called an LRAD, a long-range acoustic device, and that equipment is intended to blast out your eardrums, long-range acoustic device. And so this is military equipment which is surplus to civilian police forces. And this happened under the Obama administration. So I just want to be clear, this wasn't a Trump thing. This is a federal policy. And I want to point out that I value my civil rights. And at some level, I feel like that military equipment should not be used on U.S. civilians. And that this excessive force is a significant threat to civil liberties in this country and constitutional rights. There's a deployment at night. That's freezing temperatures and blowing propellants on people. This is our camp at Standing Rock. And, there's about 10,000 people at Standing Rock at various times. You ladies were out there, weren't you? Yeah. There's a lot of people that went out there. And for many of us, it was really a Selma moment, a moment in your movement when you say the rights of corporations should not supersede the rights of people. The rights of corporations should not supersede the rights of people. And you find who you are in the center. And you say, I'm not afraid. Tested our mettle. But I also want to point out, you guys are northern people. Camping in North Dakota is not easy. Camping behind barricades with police, surveillance, helicopters, and propellants on you is harder. And that is a pretty large camp to maintain. So give my community a lot of credit for organizing a camp like that. And then this is when we left. When Trump came in, he overturned Obama's decisions and moved ahead with full pressure on removing everyone at Standing Rock. There was a lot of things that got out, and then like solar panels, a lot of things did get out of there, but then there was a lot of things that they just bulldozed. And so this is O'Shea, this is just leaving Standing Rock. And this is O'Shea and others actually burned some of the remaining things. And as I looked at this picture, because I saw this picture, I was with LaDonna Brave Buffalo, and I said, what do you think of that? She said, it is grief. She said, it is grief. It is this moment when you do not want to have everything else that you has meant something to you taken by them, and so you burn it. And this is me getting arrested about a month ago. Don't I look happy? So, I tell you this story because I told you that we defeated a pipeline in 2016. Y'all got that, right? Then we all went to Standing Rock into 2017. They announced another pipeline, which is called Line 3. Enbridge is Line 3. Single largest tar sands pipeline in North America. The only one that at present is still standing. That is to say that it's a 915,000 barrel a day tar sands pipeline from Canada, the equivalent of 50 new coal-fired power plants. Same route that we defeated them on in 2016. And in June, a permit was approved. It's not a full permit, a certificate of need was approved for this pipeline. Many still regulatory hoops to jump through, but in approving that permit, the Public Utilities Commission of the state of Minnesota was in a room. You know, the legal system, every agency ruled against this permit. No agency recommended the permit. Administrative law judge did not recommend the permit. 72,000 pieces of testimony did not recommend it. The agency which reviewed it did not recommend it. But in a rogue decision, the Public Utilities Commission decided to approve this permit. And as they approved the permit, the commissioners looked out in the audience and looked at the Enbridge Corporation's attorneys and said, "Will you pay for the police to make sure that your pipeline can get in?" And Enbridge said yes. I point this out to you because I'm deeply concerned that a Canadian multinational corporation is going to finance the police of Minnesota to put in a pipeline that no one wants. And so, in opposition to that, I got arrested. I got arrested at the end of August. And I just, you know, I want to point out, if you're ever going to get arrested, so I got arrested with a bunch of church people. That's the way to go. That's true. You don't want to get arrested with your cousins. your brown cousins. Don't get arrested with your brown cousins. Get arrested with church people. You know, so this is in downtown Bemidji, Minnesota. And we blocked the street. We blocked downtown. And there's about, you know, 50 of us or 60 of us, and about 30 of us, I think, got arrested. And, you know, so this is me. It took us a really long time to get arrested, so this is me. I was really happy that they finally arrested me, because it took like 4 hours. The guy did not want to arrest us. He was like, the police chief was like, "Okay, I'm going to come in about an hour." And then, like, some more people come, and, you know, there's some cops. They're getting a little closer. He's like, "Okay, 45 minutes. He said, "Can you guys just please?" You know, he kept like, "Okay, I'll give you another 10 minutes, you know. I was like, "Come on." And because I wanted to get home to dinner with my kids, you know. All 4 hours to get arrested. And then I just want to say, this may not be useful to any of you, but if you are going to spend a long time protesting something, and you don't know when they're going to arrest you or the circumstances, my recommendation is to wear Depends. That's what you want to do. You can stay there a really long time. It doesn't really matter if you have a Depends on. So I just want to say that in case you need to know that. Okay. So, and I always point this picture out. So if you think that I look scary, this is my sister. We refer to her as the Genghis Khan of the Ojibwe. She's really scary. And, you know, I know that there's some trauma and PTSD work here. She has a lot of PTSD. She has a lot of PTSD, and I'm sure that a lot of the indigenous people know how that has all worked out for us, but yeah. So anyway, I go to a lot of meetings, and I say, you know, if you don't want to speak to me, you may speak to Lorna. I want to talk about the solution. I kind of told you the lay of the land, and you know, I refer to this as the Sitting Bull plan. And I do that because I feel that you know, we need to figure out where it is we're going. And I'm pretty clear that I don't want somebody in Washington figuring that out for me. And what I do know is that the great leader Sitting Bull, he said, the great Lakota leader Sitting Bull, he said, "Let us put our minds together to see what kind of future we can make for our children." And that is, I'm sure, what we have to do, is we all have to bring our minds and our hearts and our good thoughts together to make that future. So I'm going to talk a little bit about our idea of how that works. So our land is our life. That is really no different than many of you. This is a sustainable economy. This is wild rice on Lower Rice Lake on my reservation. 10,000 years harvesting in exactly the same place. That's what a sustainable economy looks like. Go to the same place. We'll see. And local food. This is some of the corn varieties that we grow. And what I want to say is that the corn varieties I grow have twice the protein and half the calories of sweet corn. They rock the B vitamins. They're like a hominy corn. Does that make sense to people? Like yeah. And so they also, because they are dry, I think a lot about the carbon footprint of storage. Do you understand what I'm saying, some of you? Like, you don't got to freeze it. You don't got to make it all special. You dry it and you let it stay, right? And a lot of our ancestors obviously were pretty frugal with how you use energy. And so to me, you know, this is an example of it. I also like, so this is corn that I grew. This is my friend Jonesy Miller growing this corn variety called Bear Island Flint. And when I got the first bunch, I got a little bit like this, and now we have fields of it. But the Bear Island Flint, the first time I grew it, it grew about this tall, and I thought I kind of failed, and because it was short, and but then I looked out there and there was an ear on it, and all it really has to do is put on an ear, and then I went out there and it was cold, and turns out my corn is frost resistant and my corn is drought resistant, and when the big winds came through, they knocked over the Monsanto varieties that were very tall, and mine stood. So the reason I tell you this is that I think it's really important to plant for a time of climate change. To plant varieties that are tough, that can hang out, that are resilient. And those varieties are going to be found in indigenous and heritage seeds. Because there's the agro biodiversity that exists in them. Monsanto and Syngenta spend about $13 billion developing climate change resilient varieties. Those are large monocrops. They're not going to grow here. So this is what we grow. I have to say that, you know, my father, when he came to see me when I was at Harvard, I'd been to school the eighth grade, and he said, you know, Winona, you're a really smart young woman. He said, but I don't want to hear your philosophy if you can't grow corn. So, you know, that's an interesting thing to say to a young woman. But I've tried really hard to be a corn grower as a result of that. And, I look at things like squash. I look at all the squashes, also a good keeper, a winter squash, you know. And then I look at the issues of energy. These are really questions of climate change resilience planning for a village, or for a community. Now, people say that you can't meet present demand out of renewable energy. I know you've all heard that. And what I'm going to say is that I would want to try to meet present demand. This is a chart from Lawrence Livermore Labs. And what it talks about is the amount of energy consumed and what happens at the end. And it turns out that we lose 57% of our energy between point of origin and point of consumption. Inefficient transmission systems, leaking pipelines, inefficient combustion systems, aging power plants, inefficient energy systems in buildings that carry ghost loads continuously. And so why would you want to meet present demand if you're wasting that much energy? Smart societies would be like the Germans and figure out how to be very efficient. How to not carry a ghost load, how to make sure that your energy is often produced much closer to home. So these are some projects that I've worked on. This is a solar project on the Navajo Reservation. This is the Navajo Tribal College at Shiprock. This is their library. And that's solar on the roof. Honor the Earth worked on that project. This is Kayenta Solar. I did not work on this. This is a tribal project, though, in a brown field next to a coal strip mine. I suppose you guys have some brown fields too. This is my village. I was talking to people earlier. I live in a perfect situation. I live in a lake on the wood, on a lake in the woods with a solar panel in a log house. I have a good situation, and I also have a farm. But the village that my family lives in, most of my grandchildren, is this village. And this village is called Pine Point, and it has everything you don't want to have in a village, from alcoholism to opioid epidemic. This village is a microcosm of a lot of Indian country. And, you know, we have the most PhDs of any village on my reservation, but yet none of those people live there anymore. And so it is not that we lack intelligence. It's just that a lot of things had happened to us. And so this is a film called The Seventh Fire, and that film, they came and they took a picture of our village, and this is a snapshot from the film. It's a still from the film when this moment occurred. But it was a really depressing film, you know, because they caught this, they just documented gangs and documented drugs. And so we saw that film, and we didn't like it too much. And so we decided we'd start doing something to fix our village up. So we started by painting our houses in our housing project. And because, you know, if you live in a tribal housing project and it don't look like much, turns out that maybe you want to fix it up. So we covered up some tags, gang tags and stuff. Nice, huh? Seven houses in the village have murals on them. My goal is to see how many we can make and turn it into a place that's kind of like a destination art. You know what I'm saying? Where people come look at the art in our village. This is another village to the north that we just started on. Step line 3. Nobody wants that pipeline. And then, this is a little bit about solar. So this is a story about some people that live in the middle of the tar sands. And this woman's name is Melina Lupacon, and she just finished her master's thesis at Victoria University, University of Victoria in British Columbia. So I was on her master's program. And for her master's thesis, her little village, Little Buffalo, the clinic in her village had a diesel generator. And in the middle of an oil region. And I know that that story is not unique. And so what she did for her, village is she, for her master's thesis, she put up 20 kilowatts of solar. And she powered her health clinic. And so I just want to say that because a lot, you know, she didn't write about it, she did it. And so part of, you know, in telling you these stories, I just want to say, like, I figure, like, if we did this stuff, other people can do it. Right? And then I was like, Melina, I want to do that. So this is me in front of 20 kilowatts we installed last year at our Pine Point school in that village. Now what we're doing is this is solar thermal panels. And what it does is it's on the south facing wall of our houses. In the wintertime, it can be really, really cold in northern Minnesota, but it is also sunny. And so it's bitter cold, but you have sun. And so this panel on the south side wall, it heats up, and when it's all heated up, gets to like 90 degrees, and then it turns a thermostat. The thermostat turns on the blower fan, and it blows hot air into your house. And it could save about 15% of your heating bill. And so I'm looking at the problem of fuel poverty in our territory, which I know exists in Alaska as well. How are you gonna heat yourself? How are you gonna keep warm? And so we started installing these, and we expect by January or February, we're gonna complete building the manufacturing facility to produce these plants, to produce these panels. And then we're gonna sell them throughout our area. And so I don't want to be really stressed out 20 years from now. I feel like that part of my situation is like the rest of you. I spent my whole life in the fossil fuel era. It's the era that I've lived in. And what I don't want to do is crash my way out without any choices. I kind of want an elegant transition. That's what I'm going for, an elegant transition. So this is our plan. This is a microgrid, a set of solar in solar gardens in a set of villages. This is a plan for the Leech Lake Reservation. One reservation over from my reservation. This is the investments into fossil fuels and the investments into clean energy. And part of the reason that I'm bringing this up is I'm fully aware that you have a pretty well-developed fossil fuel training program here. And in the future, there will be more clean energy than fossil fuels. And so to me, one of the challenges is how you make sure that you prepare the workforce for that transition. And who's going to train those people? And institutions like this could be central to training people for that transition. Because what is going to happen as cities like New York and others sue major corporations like BP and ConocoPhillips is that more money has moved each year into renewable energy as the UN and every other international agency points to the not only the threat, but the reality and the liability of climate change. So my thinking is no time like the present to begin moving towards the next economy. So this is kind of the last part of my economic model, which is that I'm a hemp grower. And I didn't really know, but I guess that marijuana is legal here in this state. I just kind of figured that out. But I don't grow marijuana, I grow hemp. And my interest is particularly fiber hemp. Because it turns out that the United States used to grow a lot of its clothing, and we grew a lot of hemp fiber. And it, you know, even the word canvas comes from the word cannabis, because that is the fiber that they use to make all those sails, all those ropes, and all that canvas, and pretty much all of the military uniforms up to the Second World War. And so I have for 3 years had a permit to grow industrial hemp. And this year, my partner Don and I got a decorticator. We had to import it from China to break up the hemp that we've... This is my hemp field. Doesn't that look like a picture from the 70s? I got this call from the tribal council who said the neighbor has complained about your noxious weeds. So I went over there because I hadn't been in my field for a few weeks, and I was like, oh, the 9-foot-tall hemp plants, that would be the noxious weeds. So that was like a day of absolutely, well, that's really fun, huh? And this is our hemp. There's Don, he's in the back of the room. This is Ronnie, he's kind of like my brother, he works with me. I have a couple of sons and a nephew. And we're harvesting fiber hemp in preparation. And this, I'm just wearing one of my, this is a hemp shirt. I would have worn my fully hemp outfit, but I felt like wearing my ribbon skirt. So 3 times the tensile strength. And the other thing that I'm interested in about hemp in particular is that it is, for a pair of jeans and a t-shirt, it's about 5,000 gallons of water. Cotton is one of the highest uses of agricultural chemicals in the world per acre. And in the world that we live in, basically most of us are wearing things that are made of fossil fuels. And so if you want to move to a post-fossil fuel economy, you need to grow your clothes. So our goal is in my community to put up a hemp thread mill so that we can provide hemp thread, because you can only import it from overseas. In fact, the whole United States no longer has a textile industry. We offshored it in the 1980s and the 1990s to China and Pakistan. So my goal is to rebuild the hemp industry. And the state of Minnesota used to have 11 hemp mills until the 1940s. So I want them back. Cool. This is what else I grow. I had some cool potatoes today, like those purple ones at that earlier potluck. That was super nice. There's my CBD hemp varieties. You all know what CBDs are? Mm-hmm. So I cannot grow anything with THC in it. but I grow high CBD varieties of cannabis. They have a lot of medicinal value. I was at a hemp research station a couple of days ago in Colorado, and they had a variety that is not hemp, it's marijuana. And I just share that with all of you, and the variety was called Nopium. Nopium. Because it's two CBDs to one THC. It's highly restorative for a lot of your nervous system and a lot of your systems that become impaired with drug use. And it's seen as a particular variety that has had a lot of success with opioid addictions. So I can't grow it, but people in Alaska could. Nopium. This is what you could also do food. This is my friend Will Allen in, he ran a project for many years called Growing Power in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Grew a million pounds of food in 3 acres using greenhouses, downtown Milwaukee. This is Arctic gardening. We were talking about it earlier. This came out of a garden in Yellowknife, Northwest Territories. My friend Lona Sorensen grew those there. You know, I know you guys have a really long, you have a lot of light. We'll go with that description, right? In the summer. And that's what she was dealing with, but they didn't have any topsoil. And so they had to make topsoil. And so what they did for topsoil, I really like her story, is they just kept layering it. I can't remember the term for it, but it's kind of like lasagna, like mommy of lasagna. Hugel. Yeah, Hugel culture, something like that, right? Yeah, and so, but they, you know what they use is, you know, they use leaves and then they did whatever they could find, and then they used caribou hair. They used caribou hair. And I was like, there you go. If you can grow that out of caribou hair, you're really cool. I was like, I cannot be a slacker if you can grow that out of caribou hair, right? So, this is me and some of my family. Some grandsons there, sons. This is us riding the proposed pipeline route. We're facing a pretty steep, I go home and I face pretty steep situation, you know? And this is what water protectors look like. We are very, you know, we're proud. A lot of us are women. We're not afraid of the Enbridge Corporation, and we are hoping that the system works. The pipelines are stopped, but we're not afraid to stand. This is where we are, and you know, I was going to say, if you didn't get a chance to go to Standing Rock this summer, it's possible you can join us in northern Minnesota. The camping will be very nice. A lot of lakes, lake camping, beautiful. 300 miles of pipe that hasn't been built that no one wants. There's our campaign, Welcome Water Protectors. This is a butterfly, obviously, from my garden. And I put this up there because there's a thing about a butterfly that I didn't really think about, but till I learned about it, is that, you know, when it goes from a caterpillar to a chrysalis and into a butterfly, that process we know as metamorphosis, right? But a butterfly does something that a moth doesn't do, in that the caterpillar itself entirely liquidates and transforms into a butterfly. And how that happens is that there are some cells that come. The first ones come, and they're called imago cells. And the first ones come, and they are all killed off by the rest of the cells. Then more of them come, and they are killed off again. But the imago cells keep persisting, and then they finally take over the butterfly transformation process and turn the caterpillar into a butterfly. It's done by some cells called the imago cells. And I tell you that, because something beautiful is made. Something as beautiful is made when you do that. But also because I consider that water protectors, that myself and that many of us here, we are the imago cells. The word imago is the same word as the root for the word imagination. And to me, this moment in time is a moment when we have this ability to imagine what we want in our future. To imagine what our villages will look like, to imagine, you know, what our future will look like, our communities, where our water will come from, and to put our hearts and minds together, you know, our good prayers and to make something that is beautiful and to make that future. I want to thank you for your time. Happy to open for some questions, but miigwech.